To him, titles don't matter. VP, CEO, GM. He's never afraid to call BS. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
And I'm burning.
Four o'clock, Monday, April 23rd, 2012. Another day, another 50 cents. Greetings and salutations to y'all. It's the radio program also on television, on The Fan, and on Sportsnet in high definition. I'm Bob McCowan. A little bit later, Michael Hiestand of USA Today. The Spaceman, Bill Lee, former Red Sox Expos pitcher. Ray Scampanella, Hall of Fame NHL linesman. We will talk about the rough stuff, the scrums. Can officials do anything to mitigate what we have seen on the ice over the past week, 10 days? Greg Zahn of Sportsnet will join us in studio, Doug McClain in studio as well, and Damian Cox, sadly, will be the co-host starting at 5 o'clock. The book is The Tower of Babel, Sins, Secrets, and Successes Inside the CBC. Richard Sturzberg is the author and joins us in studio. Nice to meet you.
Nice to see you.
So you were at CBC for how long?
6 years.
Did it seem longer to you?
Did it seem longer?
That's what
everybody in private broadcasting says. How long was it? Well, you know, when I first arrived, I was a much younger man. I had a full head of hair, was jet black.
Yeah. When you went to CBC at first, you were somewhat reluctant. Is that fair to say?
I was quite reluctant. Yeah. I was very worried. I knew exactly where they were. I mean, they'd been their television had been losing share every year for about 40 years, and by the time they asked me if I was interested in coming, it was with the lowest audiences in its history. And so you can imagine with that kind of a track record, you'd have to think twice as to whether you really wanted to go there.
Either that, or you figure, well, it can't get any lower. All I can do is be a hero here.
If it's 40 years of continuous decline, it's got a certain kind of track record.
So why do it then?
Well, I thought to myself, and a lot of people, and you know, in broadcasting business, a lot of folks, and I've been around it for a long time, said, you know, it would be unwise. But on the other hand, I thought to myself, this is Canada's, at the end of the day, this is English Canada's biggest and most influential cultural organization. It'd be fun to go and see whether it's possible to turn it around, frankly, and see whether we get Canadians to start watching it again.
Were you at the time of the belief that it was okay for the government of Canada to spend $1 billion in supporting the CBC? Did you believe that CBC was a cultural icon?
I think that it depends on which part in time you talk about. Certainly parts of the CBC are iconic. Parts of it were iconic in the past. And I saw no reason why it shouldn't be iconic again in the future.
How old are you, can I ask?
My late 50s. An age not unlike your own, I think.
So, well, and I asked that question because we both come from an era.
Yeah.
Where we sat in our living room and had access to CBC. And then I believe in 1960, CTV came on the air, if I'm not mistaken.
You're quite right.
And if you turned the rabbit ears the right direction or you had the aerial on the roof, you could get ABC, NBC, and CBS. That was it.
Yep.
And if the president was talking on in the United States, it was on all three channels. So that's ruined that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there you sat. And a good portion of my life was centered around CBC.
Yep.
And I raise that issue because I wonder if the monopoly, near monopoly in the 60s, and then even until cable came in,
mm-hmm.
may have set a precedent, a feeling, a something within CBC that was and maybe still is difficult to take away now.
I don't think you're wrong. And the fact is that when people allow an organization like that to decline and lose share for 40 years, then you got to ask yourself, you know, what is it within the culture of the place that permitted that to happen? You know, how is it that people can live with that year in, year out, as time goes on? It's a very strange thing. And so you're quite right to say that there were cultural issues within the corporation that had to be fixed if it was going to be turned around and if it was going to improve its relationship with Canadians.
The other interesting part of CBC is the political ramifications that exist that don't really exist in private broadcasting. I mean, they do to some extent, but the mandate of broadcasting in two languages and to make sure that you don't offend either of the languages fundamentally in your, not only in what you produce, but in your, in the dissemination of funds, in the distribution of assets.
I think you're talking about Don Cherry and the French visors problem.
Well, no, but you have.
That's okay too, though.
Yeah. But in the institution that is CBC is also Radio Canada.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's a story I tell in the book, which is that one of the very first things my French counterpart said to me when I arrived, a guy that I knew from before and admired very much, a guy called Daniel Gour, he said, "Okay, Richard, welcome to the CBC. When are you going to fire Don Cherry?" That was his opening salvo for me. And I said, "Well, you know, Daniel, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon." But we did. You know, I had a conversation with Don about this, and this was the whole, you remember the whole controversy about French guys, you know, wearing visors, and so they weren't real tough guys. And so Don and I had a conversation about it, and, you know, we sorted it out. It wasn't a problem.
Did you ever come close to firing Don?
No, I never did. And I'll tell you why. I think I like Don Cherry a lot, and whether one agrees with his particular view about hockey or not, he's an iconic figure. He's a good guy. He's a guy you can talk to. He's a guy who's very much admired and who's a very generous guy. So when we would have differences of view, all that would happen is, you know, we just sit down and have a conversation and sort it out. I give you a different example, which was more fun. You remember, I'm sure you do, the Panzification controversy?
Sure.
When Mike Milbury got a little overheated.
Yeah.
And so suddenly what I had was I had the kind of gay community, so I had Rick Mercer and everybody phoning me up saying, "Hey, come on. We can't have this kind of talk." And, you know, casting us as pansies, I mean, it makes us suggest that we're not tough guys. And I said, "That's fair enough." And so we sent out the word to Don and said, "Don, listen, can you give us a hand with this? Because this is no good and it's not fair." And sure enough, he went off to Coach's Corner that very evening or two evenings later, whenever it was, and issued one of his famous sallies and put an end to the pansification controversy like that. Killed it stone cold dead.
Since we're in the sports milieu, let's stay there for a second. CBC's position as a sports broadcaster has diminished significantly over the last few years.
It has.
Was it deliberate?
No, not at all. To the contrary. I mean, I tried to buy the Olympics. A lot of this is described in the book, and then got outbid by CTV, who spent a colossal amount of money to buy 2010 and 2012 to buy Vancouver and London. So much money did they spend that they themselves have admitted that they've lost a fortune on the games. We couldn't obviously bid at that level. If we're going to build on these kinds of assets at the CBC, you have to make money off them. So we couldn't engage in crazy bidding. We lost the CFL contracts, also to TSN. They even came and took away the hockey song. You remember that. That was a bad business.
Well, it was bad, but I mean, you guys did start that.
No, we didn't start that.
Well, there was a cat fight that went on, Richard.
They paid $3 million
history.
For a jingle. We did manage to secure the Hockey Night in Canada rights, obviously, through a very interesting and slightly long a negotiation with Gary Bettman and company. We got FIFA for the first time, so we had the 2010, 2012, 2014 FIFA rights. So, you know, we did a lot of work to try to rebuild CBC Sports, because CBC Sports is obviously a fundamental part of the place.
Yeah, but the essence of CBC was that was the network for amateur sport. That was the network for the Olympic Games.
Yes.
And not only that, and this is to the credit of the corporation, is... You know, I'm working at Rogers. We were part of the unholy alliance.
With
CTV. And I mean, some good things came out of it. But one of the things that CBC did was made sure that we were aware of who these athletes were by showing competitions between Olympics.
Yep.
Whether I watched or didn't watch isn't the point, but I knew that CBC would be there if there was a swimming meet or a track meet of some significance and there were Canadians involved. CBC was going to cover that. And some of that was lost with the Rogers CTV consortium.
No question, that's true. And in fact, one of the things that was enormously disappointing to me in the context of the Olympics negotiations was we had assumed that what the International Olympic Committee wanted was what they said they wanted, which was actually a celebration of sport. But it turned out, and so we had built all of our stuff. You know, the promise was you will never meet somebody on the podium for the first time.
Right.
So that the athletes would be introduced, and you're quite right, that we'd cover all the swimming meets and the skiing meets and so on and so forth. And everybody would get to know who the great Canadian amateur athletes were, so that by the time they got to the games, you would know them. And we thought that's exactly where the IOC was. But it turned out that was not so. What the IOC was a professional sports league.
And they wanted money.
They wanted money.
Period.
And that what told the tale at the end of the day was money. And I think you're right. Something very serious was lost in that.
Richard Sturzberg is the author of the book, The Tower of Babel. Off sports for a bit. Well, let's get to the core of the discussion about CBC. And I sort of started to get into it at the beginning of this discussion, and we went another direction, which is fine. But so tell me why Canadian taxpayers should cough up $1 billion, give or take, a year to support CBC, to make CBC happen.
Well, there's different aspects to it. Let's put CBC Radio to one side. I mean, that's an absolutely unique experience, I think it's fair to say. But coming back to CBC Television, which tends to be the most controversial part, there's a little story at the beginning of the book which I think captures it completely. At one point, I was invited to come down and talk to the French television and movie producers in Montreal and to explain what we were doing in English. So I for my talk, I said, let me show you what's going on in English Canada. So I put up basically a list of the top 30 shows in English Canada, and I put a little flag beside each one in terms of its country of origin. Every single one was from the United States of America. If I had done the exact same thing with respect to the most popular shows in Quebec, they would have all had little Canadian flags beside them. They were all aghast. They couldn't believe that this was possible. I said, yes, it's absolutely possible. The greatest cultural challenge that English Canada has had, perhaps since the beginning of television, was in fact to make Canadian shows that Canadians want to watch. Canadian entertainment shows, dramas, comedies, reality shows, et cetera, et cetera. Neither Global nor CTV will ever put those on in deep prime time for all the reasons you understand as well as I do.
Sure.
So the only place in the country which will actually do that is the CBC. So if you think it's important that we have a big popular culture, if you think it's important that we have our own dramas and our own comedies with our own stories and our own sense of humor and our own sensibility and all that kind of stuff, the only place you can do it is the CBC. And like everywhere else in the world, you'll have to subsidize it.
Why not subsidize it like PBS?
Then PBS does no original drama, no original comedy. They do no original anything of any consequence. What they do is they basically buy English shows. That's what they do. So I come back to it. It depends on whether you think a big indigenous popular culture really matters. If you think it does, then you got to pay for it. And I should say this too. It's important for people to understand CBC is the third worst financed public broadcaster in the industrialized world.
Yeah, and I mean the alternative to that, Richard, and I suppose my leanings are towards the privatization of CBC, and I confess that I'm not apologetic for it. But I would also say that okay, if you're not going to do that, if this country believes that CBC is culturally important, and I could see that, then $1 billion is about a third of what you should be spending.
Yeah, if you were to compare what we spend in Canada per capita with, say, for example, the BBC. You'd be right. The BBC gets about three times as much money per capita in a country that's twice as big as ours that broadcasts in one language and in one time zone. So,
But on multiple platforms, multiple channels.
Yeah, absolutely. But I do think that one of the things that we absolutely need, and one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is you know, it's we really should come to some kind of conclusion collectively as a country. What do we want? Do we want the CBC or do we not want it? If so, what kind of CBC do we want? And if we want that kind of CBC, then we should finance it properly. But, you know, the truth is we've dithered on this. There's no government in the course of the last 40 years that I can think of that's actually raised its hand and said, this is the kind of CBC we would like. Big, popular CBC, emphasis on drama, or not. Maybe you don't want that. Maybe you want a CBC that puts ballet dancing on TV. That's not the CBC I think matters, but some people think that. But whatever it is that you think, I think it behooves the government, because right now it's spending $1 billion of our money on our behalf. And I don't think it's unreasonable for the government to say, on our behalf, this is the kind of CBC we should have. And now let's finance it in whatever way is appropriate to that kind of an organization.
Do you believe CBC effectively uses the funds that it receives from the government?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting. People ask me about the most recent round of cuts. You may recall that in 2008, after the banking crisis, when the credit facilities locked up, everybody fell into a terrible, terrible set of problems. And, you know, we at the CBC were in the same situation as all the private broadcasters. All of our advertising revenue evaporated.
Right.
So in 2009, we had to take, we took 800 people out of the corporation and $170 million. Now what's happened is that they've turned around. They've imposed another $115 million cut over and above that. There's nothing left. I mean, that's the big problem. There's nothing left. The cupboard's bare. We sold all the assets that were still available. There's nothing left.
So what's the future?
Well, I think that that's exactly the right question. What is the future? And the question is, what would people like from the corporation? What is it that it should be doing? And I'm disappointed by the fact that there isn't a kind of clear public conversation about it. I think it would be very useful for that conversation to be initiated, and I think it would be a good idea for the government to actually say to itself, we're going to answer the question. Answer it one way or another. And you know what? In some ways, what you're saying, maybe they end up saying it should be privatized. Maybe that's a good answer. I don't know. Maybe they say it shouldn't be. Maybe they say it should be popular. Maybe they say it should be elitist. But at some point, to come to a kind of general conclusion as to what it is that we actually want here.
What do you think CBC does best?
Well, I think that what it does best right now is, I think the radio service is terrific. The radio service right now has the highest ratings it's had in its history. It's 75 years.
We should tell people that haven't listened to CBC, it's very popular.
It's very popular. And television now is much, much more popular than it was before, because it's got big shows, it's got Battle of the Blades, it's got Dragon's Den, it's got Heartland, it's got The Republic of Doyle, it's got Art of Air. You can go on and on. It's got the Rick Mercer Report. It has big, big shows that really connect with Canadians. Those are fantastic shows. Those are completely iconic Canadian shows. There are absolutely no question as to that they were made here and that they reflect us.
Yeah.
I think those are great.
Should CBC be, by mandate, 100% Canadian in primetime from 8 to 11?
It is right now from 8 to 11, 100%.
Should it be, though?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Of course it should be. Of course it should be. It absolutely should be Canadian.
Because there was a time when CBC would throw the odd U.S. program in there.
Well, you know, if you go back to the early 80s, it was mostly there was WKRP in Cincinnati. And
right,
I mean, if
sure.
you look at the primetime schedule now compared to then, it's a way better schedule, and it's completely Canadian. And then it was all Dallas and, you know, Mindy right. and Mork and whatnot.
CBC get its fair share of advertising revenue?
It does now. It does now.
Why? Why now?
Well, before, when I went, one of the exercises I did was I looked at how much I thought we should be making by comparing, I don't know if you're that heavily into advertising, but what you do is you compare the cost per thousand eyeballs,
sure.
and I compared our pricing with the pricing of everybody.
The competition,
and looked at it, and I thought to myself, well, this is very strange. Why are we priced lower than anybody else? So we worked our way through that, and then what we did was we retargeted how it was we were going to address the market, and we did that. And in fact, your new boss, Scott Moore, who was then the head of sports, I asked him to come over and run the advertising department at the same time.
Yeah.
So we reworked all that.
Did he screw that up or what?
No, actually, he did a great job. That's why he came over here and screw up this thing.
Yeah, well, he's doing a good job of that, too. I want you to know.
So,
congratulations.
No, Scott's great. He's great. And so we figured it out. And then what we did was that we reapproached the market in every conceivable way. We repriced. We changed our relationship with the agencies. We did a whole bunch of kind of stuff that most of the others can't do because they don't make their own shows by way of product placements and everything else. And interesting, in 2009 and 2010, Marketing Magazine, for the first time ever, voted CBC Media Player of the Year. I remember asking the guys at marketing, I said, hey, when was the last time this happened? Last time, they said, we never even considered the CBC before.
Yeah, never.
So now it's fully priced.
Last point. What happens to the great institution if Hockey Night in Canada disappears?
No, it's a big problem. It's a big problem. It's not just people misunderstand this. They think that they're just going to lose the margin that they make on the property. The bigger, that's true, they will. But the bigger problem is that they lose 400 to 450 hours of primetime Canadian programming.
Yeah.
And replacing that with new Canadian shows, dramas, documentaries, comedies, and whatever they happen to be, they don't have the money for it. So the real great danger is then what are you going to do? Have, you know, endless repeats of Rick Mercer? I honestly don't know. It's a very serious question.
Well, and I mean, would you or I ever have watched Juliet or Tommy Hunter.
Without Hockey Night in Canada?
Yeah, if Hockey Night in Canada hadn't been there as our hook, right, our lure.
Yeah.
So we tuned in a few minutes early, and then we stayed around a little bit later for Juliet. And, you know, it's those kinds of things.
I love, I mean, Hockey Night in Canada is a great property because it connects Canadians in a way I don't think that any other show does. No other Canadian show has that quality, that iconic quality. We did a very interesting little exercise. At one point, I was interested to know what the real brand value of Hockey Night in Canada was.
Right.
So iconic is it in the Canadian imagination. So we got these guys to go out and actually value the brand. There's people who can do it. And then when they value it, you can put it on your balance sheet, and the accountants and the tax department recognize it. We found out the brand of Hockey Night in Canada was more valuable in Canada than the NHL's brand. Unbelievably valuable.
That's
a great property.
It actually doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
The book is an extraordinary read if you are, if you're alive, because you've watched, there's nobody here who hasn't watched CBC, and if you're of a certain age, you've watched CBC all your life, from a point in time, as with Richard and I, when there were perilously few choices. The Tower of Babel, Sin, Secrets, and Successes Inside the CBC. Richard Sturzberg, the former, let me get your title correct, Executive Vice President, English Language?
That's right.
Nice to meet you, finally. And
nice to meet you.
Congratulations on the book. I wish you good luck. It's available in bookstands
now. Just go right out. Go straight down to the bookstore, run right out, and buy it before they're all gone.
Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Bob.
Richard Sturzberg, we'll come back with more. Primetime will continue. You're listening on The Fan or watching on Sportsnet.
It's Brady and Lang in the morning. Tomorrow morning, 5:30 to 9. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
You pass the arm and count on a radio program. How many networks does it take to cover the NFL draft? Effectively, none. The correct answer is none. You can cover it effectively with no television coverage. Boy, you've got to be really desperate to spend your life sitting in front of a television set and watch a draft. Hockey, football, basketball, whatever it is. Well, but there are shut-ins apparently who do it, among them Michael Hiestand of USA Today, I assume. But at least he gets paid to do it. Hello, Hiestand.
And I do get outside sometime. Maybe not this week, but... yeah, it's funny that, you know, it's stretched out for so long, and then the NFL stretched it out more than the old, you know, take care of it Saturday afternoon, a little mop-up on Sunday, to have prime time on Thursday, right. Prime time on Friday, and then a mop-up Saturday, so they even made it into a three-day deal.
I thought it was bad enough when ESPN used to show it, but it didn't surprise me at all, and I always thought it was okay.
Well, ESPN still does. You can go to two.
Oh, I know. You get ESPN or NFL Network.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it didn't really surprise me, but I always thought, well, it's filler programming, you know, going back to the day. This is what ESPN does, you know, when you don't have any games or anything, you show this kind of stuff. And I thought, well, it was kind of cute and intriguing for a year or two because, you know, it was like peeping through the outfield fence, you know, at the baseball park. You know, you get to look at something, you didn't usually get to see. But it's just become so mundane and so pedantic and so orchestrated now, too. There's nothing spontaneous about it. I mean, if the Green Bay Packers are ready to draft 8 seconds after the Chicago Bears announced their first-round pick, they're not going to the podium until they get the high sign from ESPN. Okay, now you can announce. Am I lying?
Yes. No, you're right. And what's bad about it is when it's on this week, they've even squeezed the last bit of spontaneity, and that would be a guy, you know, backstage getting a call from a team or his agent or what have you, or maybe he's in, you know, the proverbial family house with people gathered around, and they'd get the call and they'd be excited and they maybe, you know, put on a Patriots or Colts hat or whatever, which was kind of a fun little shot, you know, and the agent would often try to get in the picture hugging him or maybe grandma or you know, and now they've said, no, we're in sort of a gentleman's agreement between ESPN and NFL Network, they aren't going to show the guys getting those phone calls before they're picked, so that when Roger Goodell, the commissioner, trundles up to the podium, all eyes can be on him.
With Michael Heastan. So only a few years ago, three, four, I don't even know how long ago, I flip on the coverage, I'm sure by mistake, but I'm there, and they're talking about this guy who should have been drafted and hasn't been drafted yet. And I'm going to tell you who it is in a minute, if you don't guess. And for about, I don't know, an hour, maybe more, they keep going back to this guy who is...
Brady Quinn, right?
Brady Quinn, sweating profusely. He, at the beginning of it, his hair was neat. He had a nice suit on with the tie all done up. By about the 23rd pick, Brady Quinn looks like he's been through a hurricane. His tie is all sideways. His shirt is unbuttoned. His jacket is dripping with sweat. His hair is all askew. You remember? I mean, now that was fun, but you get that like once in 20 years, right? And now we're not even going to see that, right?
You know, that's kind of in a gray area, and I think I'm going to guess here that there are two kind of competing interests. Obviously, the NFL Network wants viewers, but it's still the NFL, and you know, ESPN would like to make it entertaining, but. Yeah, the odds of something sort of spontaneous and interesting slipping through the cracks. I mean, honestly, if this was a few years ago, I would have bet by 2012 there would have been a house band playing between picks.
Yeah.
You know, because there was a time there when between picks they would get, like, whatever semi-famous actors were, like, coming on to talk about their new movies and fill it in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I must say I don't think we need two networks covering it simultaneously. That's just my thought. I mean, of course, I felt the same way about. I feel the same way about when the president speaks. And in fact, the former head of CBC television was in here just a minute ago in the previous segment, and we were talking about the old days of television when here in Canada, if the president was making an address on television. That was it for U.S. television for the night because all three networks carried it.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel the same way about this. You know, maybe.
Well, the thing is, if you're the NFL network, this has got to be 100 times better than whatever else you're going to show.
Well, the only other thing they have is. Well, the only other thing they have, as far as I know, is the. That boot camp thing that.
Hollywood boot camp and.
No.
You're thinking maybe Hard Knocks on HBO.
No, I'm thinking about the Combine. So I was trying to think. That's the only other programming I think they have, because every time I turn it on, the Combine's on.
Right, during the standing broad jump and stuff like that.
Oh, it's just fascinating, so, as you know. Yeah.
They've got to be all in. And the problem, the larger picture, I think we've talked about this before, what ESPN worries about is not somebody coming along like another ESPN, but the death by a thousand cuts. So the NFL Network siphons off a few football viewers, and the MLB Network siphons off baseball super fans, you know, Golf Channel, et cetera, et cetera. So they have to up the ante to match, you know, specialty channels. And, you know, I think the reason why it gets big ratings is it draws on the two biggest things in American sports. The NFL fans looking to see who their team picked or their rival picked, and the college football fans.
Who want to see where their favorite player goes,
The star of Michigan or, you know, Alabama or whatever.
Right.
And that, that covers the big cities and the small towns and on a otherwise pretty slow weekend for sports.
With Michael Heastan, I want to cover another thing. I assume you've spent some time, you've watched Faraday on the Golf Channel, have you?
Yeah.
Is it just me, or is this a fascinating, uniquely great television show?
It's not just you, it is. And I have to say, Faraday is one guy who you know, when I talk to you, it just completely cracks me up. And it's been that way for years. And, you know, you can't really put your finger on it saying it's this or that. You could have a conversation about what do you want for lunch. And, you know, he's an interesting guy, had a lot of odd things. He keeps getting hit by cars while he's on his bike. And he hasn't played golf in years, even before he had these bike injuries. And, you know, it was such a good idea to put him on a show and let him go talk to different kinds of people and not get in the format. I would have thought for years that CBS would do a little bit more with him. They had him do a little segments, NFL-related tape segments and stuff. But, you know, it's really interesting, funny guy. One time at the PGA Championship, this was years ago, I followed him around. What does a golf course reporter do? They go up on the greens and look at the lie and then run out before the camera shut comes. And I realized we were walking around, it was like 1,000 degrees in August.
Yeah.
But I had to run with them or I'd lose them. And I can still see this in my mind's eye. You know how you run and you see your foot's about to land on something? And my foot was about to land on the leader's ball.
Oh, yeah.
Davis left the third.
And?
It didn't. You know how you can, like, jerk your foot away if you see it's about to land in a hole or something like that? But, you know, he was a nice guy, but he goes, this is what I have to do at the end of this, run around. And, you know, really an unusually interesting. I remember talking to him before he made his first trip over to Iraq or Afghanistan, and he was kind of like growing up in Northern Ireland. He was sort of against soldiers and occupations in general. And then he went there, and he was so impressed by the regular U.S. troops that, you know, he's put together all these kind of funny events, because he calls them IED, and a playoff of the acronym for explosive devices for veterans coming back, missing limbs.
Right.
And he's the one guy I'm in the bank for. I think he's a great guy and really funny, just naturally. You don't even know where it comes from.
So if you and I were running CBS, and I just picked that out of the hat.
Yeah.
And David Letterman announced today he was going to quit. Would you and I put Faraday in his spot? Could Faraday do a traditional 1 hour, 11:30 talk show?
Okay, now that you bring this up, the short answer is I'd say probably yes. But if you get in that traditional format, because I don't know if you remember like the John McEnroe CNBC talk show.
Yeah, and I'm misspeaking. So, Michael, we'd change it. We wouldn't necessarily, it would be a Faraday show. It would be different, but it would be Faraday's personality and interview style, et cetera, is really what the focus would be. But
exactly.
Before
the U.S. Open was in Washington, which is where I live in Washington, they had him do kind of a skit with some golfers at a theater that was sort of like, okay, there's this show coming. And, you know, it looked like something in high school, right? Like somebody just had their props. But it was funny because he was funny. So, yeah, I think you're right. You say, let's not do the traditional format, which I think, you know, McEnroe and before that Magic Johnson and other people get locked into, and it seems kind of dull. And, you know, think, what do you want to do? Which is why I think that Faraday show is good, because he's going around talking to different people. It's not, okay, our next guest will be appearing in her latest romantic comedy opening, you know, at 700 theaters Friday. And, no, I think it'd be a great idea.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. If for those of you that are watching or listening to this program, if you haven't tuned in the Golf Channel, you'd have to look it up. I don't even know when the show's on. I just saw the Bubba Watson thing again, I think last night or yesterday sometime, and I couldn't take my eyes off it. And I love his opening. I love the music. I love the little bumpers. I mean, just everything about it, him and his disheveled look. It's just, it's real interesting television. I'm a big fan. And Gary McCord apparently is on tonight, huh?
Yeah.
Boy, that'll be interesting. Gary McCord and David Faraday. McCord, who, of course, got booted out off the Masters broadcast on CBS for saying the greens were like bikini wax.
So fast, it had a bikini wax. And the other ball so far out of bounds, it's out by the body bags. Interestingly, as a side note, I don't want to inject myself in this, but McCord told me afterwards, I happened to be doing like a weekend, you know, like a Masters review.
Okay,
and I said, like, best lines of the Masters, those two. And he believes somebody had seen that in USA Today because nobody said anything to him after.
Oh, you bastard. You got McCord kicked off the Masters? And you're acknowledging that? Or he's blaming you?
That's what he told me.
Oh, he's blaming you. That's
certain guys. Now, he said it, and I put it down as best line, so what do I know? But, you know, he had, in his own book that came out a year later, had some funny scenes describing when he first met the sort of Masters czars, and he wasn't exactly wearing the right clothes or saying the right things.
Oh,
and,
I got to get out of here, Stan. I got to go. I know you're in the middle of a sentence, but I'm already late. Michael Hiestand, who admits that he got Gary McCord kicked off the Masters. 18 before the hour. It's prime time on The Fan and Sportsnet.
Blue Jays versus Royals. Pre-game with Mike Wilner. Tonight at 7. Now, more of Bob McCowan and primetime sports on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Cars better get going here. Oh, there they are. Hurry up.
Wasting all my time.
Can't have too long an intro. Because otherwise the music just fades out just as it gets good. Which I suspect is going to happen here. Pretty low, isn't it? Isn't that low? Oh, it's going. It's just, see? There you go. Disappeared. Here's one of our favorite people, the Spaceman, will join us a little bit later on. Bill Lee, former Boston Red Sox, Montreal Expos pitcher. He was at Fenway for the 100th birthday celebration on Friday. That was the day they played with the old-style uniforms, no names, no numbers. And somebody wrote, can't tell the players without a program. Well, can't tell the players with a program. What's the program going to tell you? How do you differentiate between the guys with the program? Ray Scampanello is in the Hockey Hall of Fame as a linesman. And we thought it was appropriate to talk about the officials and their responsibility in mitigating the nonsense that is going on for the majority of the playoffs. Although, I must say, things seem to have calmed down just a little bit over the last couple of nights. But Ray Scampanello will join us on the program later. Greg Zahn in studio. Blue Jays going for the sweep against the Royals in one of these unusual four-game over-the-weekend carry-over-to-Monday deals that I never like, never understood. Series should end on Sunday. That's all. Period. End of story. And then if you haven't had enough hockey, well, you'll have had enough of Doug McClain by the time he leaves because he's here for two segments. It's all coming up on Primetime.